Hello there. Today is Tuesday, June 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Supreme Court revives parts of the Trump travel ban.
Well, it is at least a partial victory for the Trump administration.
22 million more uninsured under the Senate health care bill. And President Trump welcomes the leader of India to the White House. Also ahead, how social media giants are joining together in the fight against terrorist content. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, in a blow to Republican lawmakers, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says 22 million Americans would be left without health insurance under the Senate's version of a health care bill to replace the Affordable Care Act. President Donald Trump is calling opposition Democrats obstructionists for refusing to help Republicans find a replacement for the law passed under former President Barack Obama. The White House also says CBO estimates of the cost and impacts have been consistently inaccurate. Joining me now to talk more about this is Sherry Gleed, Dean of New York University's Robert F. Wagner Graduate School of Public Service. Thank you for being with us. I know you're a health expert, so can you explain the CBO's findings?
Well, the CBO has to make two sets of estimates around the bill. One is what it's going to do to coverage, and the second one is what it's going to do to the federal deficit. Let me start with the second one because it was actually sort of a make or break. In order for this bill to be passed through the reconciliation process in the Senate, which is the process that allows the Senate to pass a bill with only 50 votes rather than the customary 60, it had to increase the deficit reduction achieved by the bill relative to the House bill, which was passed by the House earlier. And the CBO ascertained that, yes, indeed, the Senate bill would save more money than the House bill. So that was kind of step one.
Mm-hmm.
And then step two, which is an equally or perhaps even more important question, is what does CBO think this bill is going to do to coverage in America? And they think it's going to do pretty lousy things to coverage in America. They estimate that 22 million people will ultimately have lost coverage relative to the status quo a few years out. Their prediction on coverage was bad. They also suggested that most people who got coverage would be getting lousier coverage than they are now, with higher deductibles and fewer benefits.
So then if it's going to hurt these people, will it help any part of the population?
The biggest winners from this bill are the people who will get relief from the taxes they've been paying that have been used to fund the insurance expansion. So there's a tax of 3.8% on people's investment income. If their overall income is over $200,000 a year, roughly, they have to pay an extra tax on their investment income. That tax would be repealed. So that's a big benefit for people with very large investment incomes. So the big winners here are these particular groups of taxpayers.
We've heard people say this isn't really a health care bill. It's more of just a tax cut for the wealthy. Is that accurate or is that more partisan rhetoric?
From a design standpoint, I would say that's at least 80% true. The big beneficiaries here are the wealthy who will get the tax cut. To be fair, there is an element of health policy in this bill. It's a big change in the Medicaid program and the design of the Medicaid program that would essentially move a lot of the responsibility, the fiscal responsibility of Medicaid to the states and really cut back that program pretty aggressively. And there are some very conservative people who have been wanting to do that for a long time. So to the extent that the Medicaid piece of this involves really changing the program in a pretty dramatic way, that is a form of health policy.
This is sort of leaving it up to people themselves to deal with their health care issues if they can afford it, and if they can't, basically they just have to figure it out. Is that sort of what we're seeing here?
The bill maintains a lot of the infrastructure of the Affordable Care Act. It maintains a system of exchanges and subsidies and so on, but it just cuts back on all those subsidies, makes them smaller, makes them attaches them to much more skimpy plans that are allowed to have many fewer benefits in them. And it cuts back on the Medicaid expansion for the poorest people. So many fewer people will be able to afford coverage. And even those who can afford coverage, for many of them, it will be much worse coverage.
Is Obamacare on the verge of collapse?
No. The Affordable Care Act isn't really on the verge of collapse because it's designed to make it extremely desirable for insurers to enter markets that have very few players in them. So right now, insurers are balking and are very concerned. They're worried about rates that they might put, what kind of rates they can put forward, and some of them are pulling out of market. Much of that is because of the tremendous uncertainty about the future of the law, in particular the uncertainty about a particular provision of the law around cost-sharing reductions, and insurers just don't know whether they're going to get paid for something or not, and so understandably they don't want to go into markets where they're not sure they're going to get paid. If that uncertainty were resolved, there's every reason to expect that there would be insurers operating around the country, and I think that if you look at the premium increases that insurers have filed that assume that cost-sharing reductions would go forward, they're not particularly large or terrible, so the markets would probably stabilize. All the analysis that was done of the increases for 2017 suggests that the market is actually quite stable right now, and the CBO also said that the markets are stable.
Well, so what did the president mean when he said, if all else fails, we'll just let Obamacare crash and burn?
The president has the ability to cause Obamacare, or at least a piece of it, to do poorly at least for 1 year by simply failing to pay those cost-sharing reductions. So if they withhold from the insurance companies a bunch of money that the insurance companies are expecting to get, insurers will raise their rates a lot to compensate for that. And if that happens, I think he can certainly argue that terrible things are happening. The Affordable Care Act is not perfect. I don't even think anybody would maintain that it was perfect. It is far from collapsing. It has led the uninsurance rate in the United States to fall to the lowest level it's ever been. The costs are not out of control. And the things that people don't like about it are mostly the fact that coverage is not as generous as most people would like. Prices are higher than most people would like, but both of those things will only be worse under the Senate bill. There's no question about that. Coverage will be less generous even than the Affordable Care Act coverage that people feel is insufficiently generous, and premiums for most people will be higher even than the premiums in the Affordable Care Act bill, which people think are too high.
That's Sherry Gleed, Dean of New York University's Robert F. Wagner Graduate School. Thank you so much for being with us. If the Senate does approve its repeal version, either the House would have to pass the same bill or reconcile its own version with the Senate's before President Trump could sign it into law. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court said Monday it will consider the case of President Donald Trump's executive order restricting travel when it returns in October, while allowing much of the order to take effect. Trump's revised executive order, often referred to as a travel ban, halted travel from six mostly Muslim countries for 90 days and the nation's refugee program for 120 days. The president said the order was necessary to allow time to revise security screening procedures to safeguard the nation from external threats. In a statement on Monday, Trump called the Supreme Court decision a clear victory for the safety and national security of Americans. The travel order has been placed under restraining orders by courts in Hawaii and Maryland. Both rulings were sustained by separate appeals courts. Honolulu, Hawaii Mayor Kirk Caldwell responded to the Supreme Court's decision.
I'm hoping that the justices between now and October look very closely at the decision here and make a ruling that's fair and represents all of us in the United States of America. Well, I think it sends a very mixed message. You know, we are a country of immigrants, and in Hawaii, all of us immigrated to Hawaii, including the native Hawaiians. We all come together. We live well together. This sends a message that perhaps certain people are not accepted.
Well, joining me now to explain the court's decision is attorney Anna Rose Mathiesen with the California Appellate Law Group. The president's calling this a big victory. Do you agree?
Well, it is at least a partial victory for the Trump administration, not necessarily the clear victory that Trump claimed, but he'd lost in pretty much every lower court case that mattered. So getting the Supreme Court to agree to review it is certainly something of a victory. So the Supreme Court really did two things. First, it agreed to review both of the lower court opinions that stopped the travel ban from going into effect and set that case for early argument in October. So the heart of the question will be decided by the Supreme Court in October. The second thing the Supreme Court did was to allow some of the travel ban to go into effect before then. So as you remember, the lower courts, the Fourth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit, had put a stay on the travel ban, so said it can't go into effect in large parts. The Supreme Court lifted that stay, which means that at least some parts of the travel ban can go into effect. And those are as to people who have no credible claim of a genuine relationship with someone or some institution in the United States. That is, for people who don't have any close ties to the United States, the travel ban can go into effect and they can be categorically excluded. For people who do have a close tie to the U.S., like a family member or a relationship, say, with a U.S. college or job that has granted them employment, the travel ban cannot go into effect. until the Supreme Court hears argument in October.
Is this an indication, though, of how they'll probably rule going forward, since they obviously disagreed with the lower courts already?
Well, you know, when the lower courts decide injunctions, one of the main things they consider is likelihood of success on the merits. So they are very much concerned with, is this claim going to win or not? The Supreme Court really didn't talk much about that. It's certainly for granting the petitions, it simply said, there's a significant question, so it granted review. For lifting the stay, it really just said, what we're going to do is balance the equities here for people like the plaintiff. So the only people who are actually involved in this case were people with a close tie to the U.S. So it says, it's okay to put in the injunction as to those people who are similar to the people who actually sued. But for everyone else, people without any close ties, we're going to let it go. I wouldn't say it's a signal. It's certainly not the sort of victory that the plaintiffs had been getting in the lower court. But the Supreme Court really didn't say anything about the ultimate merit of whether or not they think there is religious animus here or whether or not they think Congress did give these powers to the president. So that will ultimately be decided in October after the immigration authorities and the lower court spend what's going to be a rough summer trying to sort out exactly what it means to have a credible claim of a genuine relationship with the United States.
It's my understanding that several of the more conservative justices were actually inclined to actually let the entire ban go forward.
Yes, that's true. So Justice Thomas's Alito and Gorsuch would have allowed the government to reinstate the ban for all travelers from six affected countries. And part of the reason they said they wanted to do that is precisely because it's going to be a mess for the immigration authorities and the courts to figure out exactly how you enforce this kind of new rule the Supreme Court just carved out. There still is this open question. The court seemed to address it in its opinion about whether or not in October, when the case is slated to be heard, whether or not there's even going to still be a reason for this travel ban. And so that's framed in terms of what the court calls mootness, whether or not there's still a real dispute. Because the travel ban, the justification for it was there needed to be just a temporary pause so that the government could assess its immigration policies. And then to the extent they found any problems in those countries, give them a chance to shape up. And that was either a 90 or 120 day period. That period, since most of the order will be able to go into effect, and certainly the part of the order that allows the government to undertake this internal review will be going on all through the summer until October. So the time period the administration said it needed will be long expired by the time its argument is heard in October. So the original justifications for this ban will simply no longer exist.
So then how would that work?
The court could end up saying there is no live controversy anymore. They will certainly press the government, and the government will be filing briefs addressing this issue because the court specifically told the parties to address whether or not there'd still be any sort of issue. So the court will certainly press the government on what's your justification for keeping any sort of ban in place if there is even a ban still needed. Why do you need any more time to do this pause that you claim you just needed for a short while to assess the policy?
All right. Anna Rose Mathiesen with the California Appellate Law Group. Thank you so much. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. President Trump says Russia collusion probe has turned up nothing. The U.S. to declare China as among the world's worst human trafficking offenders. A Utah wildfire grows to the largest active fire in the U.S. And rhetoric and anger are mounting in the diplomatic standoff in the Gulf. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. President Trump and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi met for the first time Monday, seeking to develop a warm relationship despite differences over trade, immigration, and the Paris Climate Accord.
This summer, India will celebrate the 70th anniversary of its independence. And on behalf of the United States, I want to congratulate the Indian people on this magnificent milestone in the life of your very, very incredible nation. During my campaign, I pledged that if elected, India would have a true friend in the White House. And that is now exactly what you have, a true friend.
Modi, on his fifth visit to the United States since becoming prime minister in May of 2014, thanked Trump for the warm welcome.
Global engines of growth hai, kyunki dono deshon tatha samajon ka chaumukhi aarthik vikas tatha inki sanji pragati rashtrapati ji ka tatha mera mukhya lakshya tha aur aage bhi rahega.
Well, the two leaders went into their relatively low-key summit looking to bolster the U.S.-India strategic partnership, but an equally important goal was simply to break the ice and get to know each other. The number of homeless in the United States dropped 3% between 2015 and 2016, but 13 states and the District of Columbia saw an increase. California is among those states with one of the highest homeless populations in the country. Within the state, Los Angeles County has seen a 23% increase in homelessness. While voters have approved a sales tax to fight homelessness, many citizens say more needs to be done. Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles.
The signs of homelessness are everywhere in Los Angeles. It is a life Destiny Prescott knows too well.
So I was sleeping in a car, sleeping at the beach.
We're seeing, an increase in homelessness at an accelerating rate in Los Angeles.
Advocates say one of the main causes of homelessness is a tight supply of rental housing in areas where the poverty rate is already high.
As the economy picks up steam, there's more spending power, comes into the rental market, and a lot of it goes out again as rent increases. So rents are moving up $100, $200 at a pop. No one's income is keeping pace with that.
The rich are getting richer, and the middle class is slowly disappearing.
Venice, a beach community in Los Angeles, is a place where homeless encampments and multi-million dollar homes live side by side.
Residents find homeless people in their backyards, defecating in their backyards. The city needs to do more to serve the homeless that are vulnerable. They need to do more to serve the residents that are making the investment.
One approach adopted by Los Angeles and around the country is the Housing First model, where a homeless person is put into permanent housing without requirements such as attending parenting classes or being free of addiction.
The human mind needs to have a home, a safe space. And so whatever it takes, we should be developing innovative approaches to creating those safe spaces that people control.
You know, you put them in housing and then you wrap around care. So you have home visits and case management and health care and mental health care.
Destiny Prescott and her daughter found help at a housing program called Path Gramercy.
We're in our own space. We get to lock our door. We have our key. It just feels nice. Makes me feel good.
It's the kind of solution Los Angeles hopes expand on, building new housing and turning existing buildings into permanent housing for the homeless. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues now. We want to tell you that you can learn more about the battle for Mosul from VOA's reporters on the ground in a multimedia special report at voanews.com. Well, turning now to social media, we're joined by Andrew Palchevsky. Hey, Andrew, what's happening today?
well, one of our favorite topics, fighting extremism online. This is something that we've talked about quite a lot because it's something that the social networks are doing quite a lot. And today was no exception. Social media giants Facebook, Google, Twitter, Microsoft, they're all forming the Global Internet Forum to Counter Terrorism. So this is yet another step that they're taking to counter extremism online. Now, with this Global Internet Forum, they're going to specifically share solutions about how to remove terrorist content and how to cut down on terrorist content on the networks. They're going to have some research looking into their efforts and what's working and what's not. And they're going to work with counterterrorism experts to find out specifically tactics they can use to fight against hate speech, to fight against extremism, to stop people from finding extremism content, and for people to shy away from that kind of thing. So they're starting to use these methods, kind of high tech. They're devoting a lot of effort, energy, money to these kind of things. We've talked about in the past how Google, for instance, with YouTube, is using ad algorithms to try to steer people away from content and towards anti-terror content. So this is yet another instance of that, that they're forming this group. I wouldn't be surprised if this is not the last time that we hear about this, where I think we're going to hear more and more about these kind of groups and initiatives going forward with social networks. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see additional social networks joining on to this, maybe some of the smaller, more regional ones, as this develops, because those are some of the networks that terrorists are using as well, in addition to the Facebooks and Twitters of the world. So.
And it's I would imagine, pretty hard to contain given the far reach of social media.
It is. And that's actually part of the problem, too, is a lot of these extremists are now using encrypted apps. So I think a lot of those, like WhatsApp and Telegram, I think those will be joining on to this as well.
Okay. Anything else going on?
Yes. So a fun story, because we always like to end with a fun story.
Yes.
Rihanna, of course, known to people around the world, one of the most followed people on Twitter. Huge celebrity, huge singer, great star. But also education activist. So she was tweeting on Monday at the president of Argentina, the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, French President Emmanuel Macron, and the head of Germany's information agency, and she was asking each of them what they plan to do about education funding. So this got a lot of attention, naturally. Anytime Rihanna tweets, it gets a lot of attention, but it got a lot of attention when she sent it to these high-profile figures. And many of them responded. So you had Argentina's President Mauricio Macri. He responded, "Hola, Rihanna. Education is the central core of our political aims. Only education can change the world." Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, saying that he's got Rihanna's back, making sure girls' education in particular is in our feminist international development policy. And it wasn't just world leaders that were jumping on this. Pop star Demi Lovato, she got in on the tweeting too, and she wrote, "Education is one of the key tools for mental health and well-being." All it took were a few tweets from Rihanna, and all of a sudden now people are talking about education and girls' education, funding for education. So it really shows not just the power of celebrity, but the power of celebrity on social media. All it takes is a couple clicks on the phone to send out a message like this, send out a public tweet, and it gets the world talking.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Andrew. Very cool. You can find him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, close to 80 people, mostly young children, have gotten measles in the U.S. state of Minnesota. Nearly all were unvaccinated. Now, despite a vaccine that does prevent measles, many people in the world don't get their children vaccinated. That's why pediatricians and public health doctors now want to spread the word that the vaccine is safe and it works. VOA's Carol Pearson takes a look at measles to find out why.
Many people think measles is just another childhood disease, a rash, a fever, and it's gone. But top doctors say otherwise.
Measles is not a trivial disease. If you have a measles outbreak, a proportion of people are going to have serious complications.
Measles can cause permanent brain damage. It can leave a child blind or deaf. Measles also kills.
In the pre-vaccine era, before we had the measles outbreaks, we had about 500 kids die every year of measles in the U.S. and 50,000 hospitalizations.
Most people get better within 2 weeks, but the effects can linger.
If a child acquires measles, even in a country like the United States, he can have complication of measles that can be deadly, like pneumonia, or he can have like a reduction in his immune functions. He can also have malnutrition for quite some time after. So the child becomes weaker and more susceptible to other infections.
All it takes is a sneeze or a cough to spread the virus in tiny droplets through the air. One person can affect up to 18 others. Each one of those people infects another dozen or so, and it spreads from there. 90% of those exposed will get the virus unless they've been vaccinated or have already had measles. The measles virus can linger on doorknobs, tables, any surface for up to 2 hours. Touch it and you're exposed.
It's incredibly contagious. And the kids who get measles are really, really sick. I mean, it's a pretty big deal to get measles.
The first signs of measles are a runny nose, cough, and a fever followed by a red rash. Measles is not just a childhood disease. Adults can get it too. The American Academy of Pediatrics has asked doctors to work with parents who are reluctant to get their children vaccinated. Dr. Hope Scott at Reston Town Center Pediatrics in Virginia says her practice will allow parents to set up a delayed vaccine schedule to a point.
We'll work with them probably till about age 2 or so. And if they've not vaccinated by then and don't have a plan to do it and aren't acting on the plan, we will at that point ask them to leave the practice.
The single best way to prevent measles is to get 2 doses of the measles vaccine. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends children get the first dose after their first birthday and the second when they are between 4 and 6 years old. The 2 doses together provide 97% protection against measles. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Top U.S. officials recently met with their Chinese counterparts in Washington in the first session of the diplomatic and security dialogue between the U.S. and China since it was created by Chinese President Xi Jinping and President Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago in April. At a press briefing, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson called the discussions productive, dealing both with the possibility of expanding cooperation, where the two countries have a shared security interest, and addressing issues where the United States and China have significant differences. The security threat posed by North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile program, which the United States regards as the most serious threat facing the nation, was a leading topic. Secretary Tillerson said he emphasized to Chinese officials that they have a diplomatic responsibility to exert much greater economic and diplomatic pressure on the North Korean regime if they want to prevent further escalation in the region. Another frank exchange of views occurred over the South China Sea. The U.S. position remains unchanged, Secretary Tillerson said. We oppose changes to the status quo through the militarization of outposts and excessive maritime claims unsupported by international law, and we uphold the freedom of navigation and overflight. He noted that China committed to resolve their disputes peacefully and in accordance with recognized principles of international law, including the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. During the discussions, the two countries also decided to increase coordination to face the global threat posed by terrorism and to work toward a long-term risk reduction effort between their militaries and government. Lastly, the United States was clear about its determination to stand up for human rights and universal values. We will not be shy about raising our concerns about China's human rights record, Secretary Tillerson stated, adding that he had been direct and candid with the Chinese about the issue. Secretary Tillerson said the action items agreed to by the two countries during the dialogue have set the foundation for additional areas of cooperation and have started the implementation of President Trump's vision for a constructive, results-oriented bilateral relations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.